Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Coming up on the program this week, have you ever failed at something before? Of course you have. You're not a robot. Neil Pasricha is here to tell us why we should embrace our failures. Well, maybe you should. His latest book is called You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle Failure, and Live an Intentional Life. Then, we've got a new game for you. It's called The Credit Game. Sounds fun, right? You're going to want to win at this one. It's going to make a big difference in your life. Richard Moxley tells us how to win the game in his book, The Credit Game, Rules Every Canadian Must Know to Win. And a new survey shows many Canadians are struggling to get out of debt, and the battle is only getting more challenging. Lori Campbell, CEO of Credit Canada, joins us to address some of those challenges. Plus, the founder and CEO of Milo, Philip Barrar, here to talk about access to financial advice, how to get what you need when you need it. All that's ahead. Let's get started. We all experience failure at some point in our lives, whether it's failing a driver's test or getting fired from a job. In that moment, you might feel like your life is over. But our next guest argues that failure could be good for you. In fact, even a critical component of your development as a resilient human being. Neil Pasricha is the author of the book, You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, and Live an Intentional Life. He joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I love this title because it seems so inconsistent with what the book is about. Mm. You Are Awesome sounds like Stuart Smalley from Saturday Night Live with his, you're good, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me.
Should we call it, I know, maybe we should call it You Are Not Awesome.
You Are Not Awesome. No matter what anybody says, you are resilient.
I don't know if that would have got by the sales and marketing team.
You are resilient, it could be.
Yes, yes.
So what is this book about?
Here's the thing. We live in an era of infinite abundance. We've got longer lifespans, higher education rates. We've got it. You can press a button on your phone and the car picks you up, drives you home. By the time you get home, you got steaming takeout on your porch because you ordered it from your car. Your phone's entertaining you. We live better than kings lived 50 years ago. We live like kings.
Yeah.
Like my kids have three pillows in their bed. That's disgusting. But like, I'm just like, we live better than anyone. But then at the exact same time, because we live like kings, we have not developed tools to handle failure or even perceived failure. You put your kids in cello classes now, and then you just push them up with gold stars and participation ribbons till they succeed at whatever they're doing. I talked to a high school teacher yesterday, no joke, emailed me, and he's like, I can't put kids in failure situations anymore because the parents won't allow
it. They'll go insane.
We got to have perfect resumes, otherwise they won't get into the fancy schools. So here's the problem. Now when you get three likes on your photo, you think, you got no friends. And you get a rude email from your boss, you call in sick the next day. No wonder we got 1 in 3 college students with clinical anxiety. Those anxiety rates, by the way, are up 30% over the past 5 years.
You and I are parents now, so we have skin in this game because we don't want to raise kids who are like this. How do you—
And I'm like this too.
Are you really?
Yes, I'm very thin-skinned.
Really?
Yeah, I'm fragile. I wrote this book for me. And the side benefit is my kids might read it.
Really? Because I wonder how this sells to the snowflakes out there. And you're saying it sells because you are yourself,
well,
a snowflake.
And part of what I'm trying to do with the book, Bruce, is like teach people how to build in some of that musculature. I call it resilience. You know, that's a big buzzword these days. But I'm like, okay, if everyone taught you till you're 22 years old that you're perfect— then how do we build in some of this mental strength?
How on earth did you become one of those people based on your family of origin? Your mom was born in Kenya. She moved to England. She had an arranged marriage, moved to Canada. She had like every extraordinary experience to build resilience. And she didn't pass it on to you? Give me her number. I am calling her because she has failed.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I said to the high school teacher when he emailed me yesterday, he's like, well, you got to let your kids fail. You got to put them in situations where they don't do well or they don't get first place or they suck at something because that's how you build that muscle. We don't let people do that. And you're right. My mom did come here scrapping and saving. My dad scrapping and saving from India. And they tried their whole life to give my sister and I a perfect childhood. Right. Don't you want your kid to be happy?
Of course.
So what do you do for them? Don't you buy them nice clothes and put them in a good school and always like take care of them? Like you got skin in the game. You just said you got skin in the game. So what are you doing to build failure in your kid?
Well, I tell you, here's a great example. I let her get lost at the grocery store.
Totally lost?
Now, in the retail store near my house, so it wasn't like a superstore. And I said, Abby, if you would like to wander around the store, you need to know where I am. And if you get lost, what do you do? Whatever, whatever. Of course, she gets lost. And she's gone for maybe 3 minutes. I can't find her. Another parent finds her. She does this big show of tears. But she's not upset because we had the plan.
Yeah.
And now she failed in a safe environment. So I never worry about her. Abby, what's the rule? You can't find me, you call my phone. What's my phone number? Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, wow.
She's good to go. So she is one of the most independent kids. I think that's partly her temper, partly her temperament,
yeah,
and partly how amazing I am as a parent. Because really, I mean, it's like I'm extraordinary. So that's an example for me with what Abby, who's now 10, she was probably 5, maybe 6 when we did that. What are some of the connections to money here? So this is a show about personal finance. There's lots of examples in which people fail. They fail at real estate. They fail at investing. They fail at paying off their credit card debt.
Sure.
What are some of the most compelling connections you would make between your book, your approach, your life philosophy and personal finance?
Well, here's the thing. In this book, You Are Awesome, I'm trying to teach people ways to build up their resilience. One of the ways I talk about doing that is something called finding small pawns. Okay? So like you got to put yourself in a game that you can win in order to build up your confidence and your resilience goes up. So I have a chapter in the book called Why You Shouldn't Buy the $5 Million Condo. Have you ever opened up a New York Times magazine or some fancy magazine and says like brand new condos on the Hudson River in Manhattan starting at $5 million? Here's a money connection for you, Bruce. I'm like, who would buy that? You're buying the second floor condo facing the courtyard. You are the loser of the building starting at $5 million. But that would buy you a penthouse suite anywhere else. So we talk about money. Don't put yourself in a game that you are going to lose and feel like a loser. Put yourself in a game that you can win. How did I get this advice? Well, when I went to Harvard Business School, the dean told me, hey, how's it going looking for jobs? And I was like, it sucks. Everyone's trying to get a job at like Google and McKinsey and it's so hard. And, you know, we got these millionaire bankers with black bags in their eyes and everybody wants to be one of them. And there's only 10 jobs available and there's 1,000 of us. He's like, oh, you're going to become a small fish in a big pond. And even if you land one of those jobs, you'll be looking over your shoulder forever. So instead, go find the nerd at the library. Don't try to find the hot babe at the beach. And instead, go find someone that isn't flying to Harvard Business School, is more like a broken company or a bankrupt company. That would put you on a path where you can do well once you get inside.
How does that square with the universal wisdom that your income is connected to the income of the 5 people who are closest to you, the friends that you have? You and I both went to the Queen's University School of Business. It is a very fast crowd. We chose a very aggressive type A place to go to school.
Uh-huh.
And would you say your advice to your kids is don't go to the top business school in the country?
Well, I would definitely say go somewhere where you can be successful. Absolutely. I would not say don't go to the top business school. I would say go wherever you want to go. And I don't even know if you want to go to school. I'm not going to pressure my kids to go to school. They might want to be an artist. They might want to become the world's greatest graffiti painter. I don't know. I can't tell them what they're going to be. But what I can say is put yourself in a game that you can win. You want to do that by putting yourself somewhere where you're, they call it academic self-concept in the research. Put yourself somewhere where you can be a 9 in a group of 5, not a 5 in a group of 9s. Why? Your academic self-concept, which is how you think of yourself, it goes up and it stays up for even more than 10 years after you leave that pond or that experience.
It would almost say that you would recommend parents don't put their kids in the gifted stream.
I would totally recommend. Look, I'm saying tee off at the tees closest to the hole. Sign up for the marathon in the slowest category. Go somewhere where you can win because just winning helps you develop mental strength.
But doesn't that play into the whole snowflake mentality that we have to win all the time?
No, it's weird. I know it sounds like a paradox, right? It sounds like a paradox. I'm not saying win all the time. I'm saying when you're feeling high anxiety, mental illness is up, depression is up, loneliness is up. We feel terrible, Bruce. Whether or not you or I feel terrible today, this minute, the society right now is we are not feeling good. What do we need? Resilience. How do we build it? One of the ways to do it is put yourself in small ponds or put yourself in games that you can win so you cheer yourself up. I got a One other thing I talk about in the book that's kind of related is I have a 2-minute morning exercise you should start your day with every
Tell us about it. I think it's brilliant. Tell us about it.
Don't look at your cell phone. Let's start with that. I sometimes go to an audience and they're like, how many people look at their cell phone first thing when they wake up? Every single hand goes up in the air. How many people look at their cell phone before they go to bed? Every single hand goes up there. If you drank a bottle of wine before bed and when you got up in the morning and slept with your bottle of wine on your bedside table, we'd all call you an alcoholic. We're all phone-aholics now, and we use that dopamine hit in the morning, and it makes us feel horrible because we're comparing ourselves to everybody else, and it feels bad. So what do? Start with a 2-minute morning practice before you get out of bed. Ask yourself 3 prompts. Super simple. I will let go of, I am grateful for, I will focus on. Would you believe, Bruce, that I actually write these 3 things down every single day?
I would believe it because you're you.
I totally believe it. Whether or not.
What's an example of something you would let go of?
I would let go of today. Because this book just came out. It's been out less than a week. I don't know if it's going to be on the bestseller list. We don't find out till Wednesday or Thursday. I have to let go of that. I can't determine if it's a New York Times bestseller. That's not up to me. It's up to the New York Times. I have to let go of that. 5 pounds I gained over the holidays. Comparing myself to Tim Ferriss. Whatever it is. You could let go of whatever you write down. And you know what happens when you write it down? You actually stop thinking about it all day. There's research behind this.
Right.
I am grateful for. We know it's important to prime your brain for positivity. And I will focus on, it's important to carve a will do from the endless should do and could do list that we all have. We have decision fatigue. I will focus on helps us streamline our thinking for the day. Those 3 little prompts are what I call a 2-minute morning intervention to strengthening your mind.
Super practical. I was talking to a listener 2 weeks ago. A lot is going wrong for her in the area of money. They're still afloat, but a lot's going wrong. How do you call the failure? Because in today's day and age, it's very easy to be failing for long, long periods of time.
Yeah.
Because there's no cataclysmic event, right? Like your marriage, you've been very public about that first marriage and how suddenly your wife asked for a divorce.
Me.
Yeah, she left you. So that was a failure, but you were, I'm using air quotes here, failing for a period of time in that marriage. You describe, you know, how that wasn't like hooray for everything all the time.
So let me kind of soak back into that sort of gray muddy area we've been exploring, which is how do we talk to our children? And if you listen to any kid's commencement speech today, there's somebody on stage wearing a cap and gown, getting an honorary degree, saying something like, do what you love, follow your heart, chase your passion. That's what we tell our kids. You know what we should be asking? This is related to your question. We should be asking, do you love it so much you can take the pain and the punishment too? You know, Mark Manson, he wrote that famous book, Subtle Art of Not Giving. I won't say the swear word.
Yep.
Okay.
Rhymes with duck.
Exactly. Rhymes with duck. He wanted to be a rock star. I've actually heard him talking about how openly he was. He was like, I couldn't handle lugging an amp to a smoky nightclub at 2 a.m. on a Tuesday for 6 years and practicing the 6 chord progression for 6 hours. I couldn't handle that. But getting into Facebook comment wars, that was my jam. I loved doing that. So I became a better writer because I took that pain and punishment along the way. Whatever it is you want to do, ask yourselves if you're up for the stress that goes with it. You and I talk about money. We talk about work stuff. Hey, if you want a new job and you're listening to this, are you up for handing out 100 resumes? Are you up for getting 50 no callbacks? Are you up for going to 25 first-round interviews? Are you up for getting a rejection from 24 of them? That's the pain and the punishment to getting a new job. Are you up for that? If not, you're not going anywhere. You're stuck here forever.
Now, you argue that people should talk more openly about their failures. I understand that theoretically. I think in practice, it's very, very difficult for people to do.
Yeah.
How do you go about doing that? For someone who doesn't have the platform that you have, and this is a part of it. I mean, it's on brand for you to talk about success and failure. It's who you are. It's a self-expression. But for the average person who's working as a manager in a mid-sized corporation, what do they invite everybody to lunch and talk about their failing marriage?
So I used to, I don't know, you know, I was 10 years at Walmart, right? I'm in human resources. So I did a lot of time interviewing people. And people aren't usually going to lie on their resume. People won't do that. But you know what they do? Omit.
Right.
So what you do is you look at the resume. If I'm the interviewer and I'm like, huh, there's a 6-month gap here, you know, after you graduate from college and before you started your job. Or there's a 12-month gap here. So I always picked and prodded at those gaps. You know what I found? Things that people are uncomfortable talking about. They called them failures in their mind. You know what I called them as the interviewer? Crucible moments. That's where they discovered themselves. They went on a trip to India. They became a yoga instructor. I want to know about those. So when you look at your LinkedIn profile, you look at your resume, what are you omitting that you could simply be more public about? out. You could call it a failure. I call it a failure. But what did you learn from it? Because that's what we really want to get out in the open.
You have a whole bunch of really practical tips. Lose more to win more. Go to parties where you don't know anyone. The thing that caught my – one of the things that caught my attention is have a failure budget. Mm. What does that mean?
So January 1st of every year, I am remarried. For those that don't know my entire life story, I'm remarried. My wife, Leslie, and I have been together for a while now. We have three little boys, 5, 3, and 1. Okay. On January 1st of every year, would you believe we do this? We take money from our joint account and we put it into our personal accounts that I can't see hers, she can't see mine. It's our failure budget and also how we buy gifts for each other. Because I don't want to buy her a blender and her say, I don't like this blender and I paid for half of it. That stinks. So what do I do in my failure budget? I just try stuff that I don't know if it's going to work or not. I take a cooking class and something I don't know if I like. I'll go to like a music festival that I've always dreamed about going, but I just don't know if I can pull it off. I do my podcast. My whole podcast, 3 books, is my failure budget. I got no ads, no sponsors, no promotions, nothing. I make no money off it, but it's an experiment to see if the conversations I have in that medium can enable me to become a better person. A failure budget is really important because we don't want to, you shouldn't overthink whether you should spend a little bit of money every year on trying something so far out of your comfort zone that you might enjoy it, and certainly you will learn a lot from it.
So how do you have someone execute on that idea who already has $3,500 outstanding on their credit card, and they can make their minimum payments, but they aren't making headway on that credit card?
So then I say do the number of digits test. Look at your income. Start with, do you have an income? So if you have an income, then move the digits over 3 places. So if you're making $25,000 a year, make $25 your mental failure budget. Like, I'll take a chance and go to this jazz club tonight. I've never listened to jazz before. I don't know if I like jazz. I'll take a chance on it. Maybe I'll take a Rosetta Stone language course to learn Japanese. I love manga, but I never learned Japanese. I'll just take the first course. Try some things that are just a 0.01% of your actual income, so it's a small enough dose that you can handle it, but still put yourself in situations you will be uncomfortable with, because when you know the least, it's when your learning is the steepest.
Untouchable days is another very tangible, practical idea in your book. What is an untouchable day? And what are the excuses that people are already going to have in their mind that you're going to address head
on? So in You Are Awesome, I write about how, ironically, when I was trying to write You Are Awesome, I had no time to write it. I had quit Walmart, and people are like, so how's, now you quit your job, how's the new book coming? And I was like, terribly, because my day just fills. That's what everyone's day does. You think you did nothing, you look at your sent items, you get 147 emails, or you have all these meetings that you couldn't really get anything done in between. So I took a drastic step, Bruce. I decided to create one untouchable day a week. What's an untouchable day? It's a day where I am literally unreachable, untouchable, uncontactable by anyone at all, including my wife, all day. I mean, I'm in airplane mode. I don't even go on the internet. Nothing. My wife doesn't even know where I am. Why does it work? Because my productivity goes up 10 times. I write 5,000 words on those days. That's how I do my best work. The untouchable day has become a salvation for me. It is the number one way to strengthen your mind and actually get more done. But of course, as you pointed out, when I tell people I do this, they always say, oh, well, easy for you to say. You're a writer because you're a writer, so you could do that. I'm like, no, I'm doing that. I'm a writer because I do that. I'm able to write books because I have that time. Oh, people say, oh, what about emergencies? I'm like, get over yourself. How often does your kid break their leg? Are you kidding me? There's a phone at the school. You don't have to worry about all this stuff. People, nobody had cell phones, okay? Nobody used to have them. You don't need to know where, you don't need to track. I have a friend, him and his wife, they track each other's location all day. I mean, seriously? Don't get me started on this.
I accidentally did.
It's important to go off the grid sometimes and let your thoughts ferment and congeal and release your most inspiring and creative thinking.
So we, now you and I are values aligned on this, absolutely, but we live in a world that is not. We live in a world today in which there are participation medals and there's so much, people would call it compassion and empathy, but you and I might call it an inability to accept failure and a disinterest in developing resilience. How do you think you will talk to your kids in 5 or 10 years that is different than how a parent of a kid that age will talk to their kids about the failure that they received in school or the rejection they got from that girl or that boy or whatever? How do you think that those conversations are going
to go? Well, I'm starting those conversations now. Look, my kid is about to go to school next year, and my wife and I have made the very conscious decision. Downtown Toronto, we're surrounded by all these private schools. We're like public school. And you know what? If he has a bad teacher, good. Like, we want him to have the experience of going through education in the sense that you will have good teachers, you will have bad teachers, you have teachers that fit you, teachers that don't. I'm not going to try to pluck you into a perfect situation every year because that's the snowplow parent who's making your life easy so that you get like into some Ivy League school or whatever. That's too much. I got to let my kid fail. Kids will naturally fail. They will naturally jump off a thing. They will naturally wander around the grocery store and get lost in the meat aisle or whatever your kid's doing. And that's okay. We have to let our kids fail. Part of what being a parent and how I talk to my parent is hands off. Let them wander. Let them roam. Let them try stuff.
Does your failure budget, are you saving for the therapy budget for your children that they're going
to
need
want my
when
kids
they feel
to go
so
in
hard done by?
I want my kids to be
my
in therapy.
My dad was so hardcore, man. He was the worst.
You know what I hate? You know when people say to me, Bruce, they're like, oh, my kid's going to need therapy for that. I say, good. Therapy is like exercise for your mind.
Yeah.
It's actually, I'm in therapy. Everyone I know who's interesting is in therapy. You know what?
Really?
Are you in therapy?
Not currently, but I have.
You should be.
I am a bit.
You're interesting.
Consistently
I'm in
therapy?
Here's what I do. I change the volume. So after my divorce, I was going to therapy twice a week. Now I'm going once every 2 months.
Oh.
Now it's like I save stuff on my iPhone notes of like things to talk about and process. You know what? It's great to process things with a professional. I think of therapy as going to the gym for your mind.
I love it. It's like an intellectual spa. Totally.
And now, here's the thing. It's not always affordable for people, money-wise.
Yep.
And it's not always reachable if you go through the public system. That's partly why that two-minute morning practice I advocate and you are awesome is so productive because I will let go of running down and crystallizing and injecting anxiety actually helps you process stuff the way a therapist does. I know it sounds simple, but it really does get stuff off your chest.
So inspiring. Clearly you are passionate about this. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. I'm really passionate about this. If you aren't
We've
passionate about something, you should write a, you spend 10 years, two years writing a book
about
it. You
change the levels on your microphone here. Neil Pasricha, author of the book, You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, Live an Intentional Life, and Raise Good, Effective Children. You should add that subline.
They'll be what they will be.
They will be what they will be. Maybe they'll be know-it-alls. Maybe they'll be heads of organized crime families. We never know. Stay with us. Coming up, How to Win the Credit Game. Author and credit expert Richard Moxley is here. Later, we'll talk to Philip Barrar, founder and CEO of Milo, about how he manages his own money. And if you'd like to keep in touch with all that is Moolah La, sign up for our newsletter. Fun stuff that I have done on my podcast for financial advisors called Prosper, the columns I do on CBC Radio, the show called Cityline, which Neil is also a guest on, so it's got to be an amazing show. Sign up at moolahla.ca. It's only once a month, and I'll never do anything with your email address other than send you a monthly email. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Hockey is a game. Go Fish is a game. Exploding Kittens is a game. But you probably have to have a kid in the house to actually know this, but it is. It's a great game. Our next guest argues that credit is a game, too. Now, it's definitely a game you want to learn how to play and ideally learn how to win. But how do you play it if you don't know the rules? Richard Moxley is here to talk about his new book. It's called The Credit Game, Rules Every Canadian Must Know to Win. Hello there.
Hello.
What's the game? How do you describe the game?
Well, first of all, the game is this rules or this thing that's out there that controls our life, this three-digit magical number that is kind of out there. We know it exists, but we're kind of doing our own thing, and a lot of times we run up against it and start getting
And you open the box and there's no rules.
Exactly.
It's not like the game of life where there's rules.
Yeah, there's no credit talk when you turn 18.
How did you get into this? What was your start in learning about the game?
So I got frustrated because I was a mortgage broker, and I had to get my clients approved. And someone would say, well, they're declined because of their credit. And I would say, okay, but how do we get them from declined to approved? And then I would have to go around, and someone would say this, and another person would say this. And so there is no manual. And so I had to go and figure it out client after client.
And learn the nuance
exactly.
of how all this stuff works. Now, what is your commercial for the importance of good credit? Why do you think it matters?
I think it matters because it controls so much of our life, not only just best rates and terms. Now the insurance companies are starting to use it for premiums. It can control where you live, how you travel. And then, of course, it can even control your love life now.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when it comes to credit, now that people are going through divorce and separation, when they go and find a new partner, now they're asking more questions, right? They don't want to get in the same trap as right. they did last time.
I'm relieved. I thought you were going to say that your Tinder blows up if you're under 650. You're trying to swipe right and it's not working.
It just won't work.
It won't work anymore. Now, you also say that chasing a high credit score is a waste of time.
Yes.
A waste of time and money. Why?
Well, because the score can be different with every different lender that you go with.
Right.
Now, you had Julie on here not too long ago.
Yep.
She was talking about even Equifax.
Richard's referencing Equifax Canada. Equifax Canada, the Director of Consumer Advocacy.
Yeah, yes. So she was on here saying that there's multiple scores and a bank or lender can choose which score they're going to use. And then a bank can use Equifax or TransUnion or both or none. So all of those, when you're obsessing about a score, really distracts you from how to play the game properly.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying is play the game properly and the score will be what the score will be, but 672 versus 681 doesn't make a big difference.
Exactly. So the benchmark that I always tell my clients is 700 and above, you're good to go. Don't stress right. about it. Sometimes you need a little bit more depending on but not much more.
See, I'd be one of your people. I'm such a competitive personality. I'm like, no! I'm continually annoyed that I'm not at 900.
Yeah.
And I feel like calling them, I'm saying, don't you know who I am? I am perfect. How come I am not at 900?
I tell my wife I'm perfect, but
she doesn't believe you. Now, interestingly, this is one thing that I thought was interesting. The score that you get from the bureau, and more people are getting their scores because they're free. There's lots of different places to get them free, may not be what the bank sees. Why is that?
It's because the bank themselves, they get to decide which type of score they're going to subscribe to. And the scoring algorithms have been upgraded over the years, but they don't get rid of them. They just keep them kind of there because some lenders don't want to change and they like that and others don't. And so that's the only good excuse or good reason I can think of that why they wouldn't just have one.
Now, credit card bills are a different phenomenon than cell phone bills
yes.
when it comes to your credit. Distinguish between the two and why it is so important to pay off your cell phone bill in full. It's not that big a deal if you make a minimum payment on your credit card, but if you don't make a payment in full on your cell phone, that's a big deal.
Why? Yes. And so mortgage brokers and bank mortgage specialists are always upset when they see or they have to decline someone because of some late payment on a cell phone. And in the consumer's mind, they're thinking, well, it's just a cell phone. It's no big deal. And if you call them and say, well, I can't really pay it off in full this month, they'll say, don't worry about it. Just call us, just pay us next month. However, to Equifax and TransUnion, the moment that you don't pay the full amount, you're in trouble, you're late, and that automatically gets reported. And the lender would see that as, well, if you can't control a cell phone bill, how are you going to control
and we're
these
give
other
a mortgage?
Ones? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's crazy. Secured credit cards are a way for people to rebuild credit. We talk very, very little about secured credit. Tell us how they work and for whom they are a good fit.
So secure credit cards are great for those that are just starting out or have, trying to rebuild their credit because they get a credit card. It's like credit card with training wheels. You got that security there. And so a credit card lender will actually give you a credit card and it's connected to your name and it reports to Equifax and TransUnion. And it affects the score pretty much the exact same way as a regular credit card. The only difference is there's a security there, like a damage deposit.
And so you basically cut them a check for $1,000 or whatever the limit is so that they know there's no possible way you're going to default because they already have your money.
Exactly.
Perfect. What are the reasons? We've talked about this before, but let's underscore. What are the reasons why you should keep your balances under half of your total credit available?
So this is underplayed so much and people understand and they see the graphs online and it says, okay, so pay your bills on time. People kind of get that.
Yep.
But with this limit, they don't understand that it's not only keeping the balance under half, that you should never go over half of whatever your limit is because that snapshot can happen anytime throughout the month. And as soon as that reports, that snapshot is what Equifax and TransUnion are using to
And the jargony word is utilization.
That's right.
So they want to make sure that you're not getting anywhere close to your limit because if you have a job loss or some other calamity, you need to have some wiggle room there.
Exactly. And their stats would show that those that are over the limit, closer to the limit, those are the people that will default more regularly than someone who's, you know, generally keeping their balance under the halfway.
You talked about your love life earlier. You have many great case studies throughout the book, and they really are compelling and terrifying examples of people in credit. What's that anecdote around the relationship in which it was a woman with a man? They signed up for a joint card.
Yes.
He raised the limit without her knowledge. He overspent, and then suddenly she was left holding the bag.
Yeah, the love story that ended.
Yeah, that is not a love
story.
Yeah.
So that happens a lot, and joint credit is extremely dangerous, and so I always tell people, listen, if you're going to do it, that's fine. Just know that you are 100% responsible for the balance, the full balance, and the minimum payment. So if you separate or something happens, you don't just pay half and you're good. No, your name's on it. You're 100% responsible. So what happened there was essentially they had started with just a low limit credit card, thought, hey, we're a couple now, so let's get a credit card together. Terrible idea, because that he can or she can, whoever it is, whoever's on the name, their name is on the card, they can increase that limit whenever they want. And they don't have to get permission right. from the other one.
Right.
So that's dangerous.
You draw an interesting distinction between, you call it the B word and the F word. Those are...
Don't tell the kids.
I will not tell any of your five children that you are not swearing.
Yeah.
But bankruptcy versus foreclosure.
Yes.
What is the important, hopefully no one will ever have to be having that talk in the real world, but they do. It happens.
Yes.
So what's the difference between the two, and what perspective would you provide on the two?
So a lot of people look at bankruptcy as the worst thing that you could ever do for your credit. And obviously it's not going to help. And there's other debt programs, but bankruptcy, rebuilding of bankruptcy can... your credit after a bankruptcy can happen pretty fast, within 2 years, actually, which kind of...
Not completely, but parts of it.
Well, you can get back to best rates and best terms within 2 years, and if you do it right. And then foreclosure, though, even if you rebuild and you do everything right, essentially, you're not going to get mortgage financing for the next 6 or 7 years until it falls off your credit report, which really sucks. So even if you've reestablished and you've done real well, then... you're still not getting that mortgage because the banks see it and they're like, no, we're done.
What are some ways that you believe people could get better at paying their bills on time?
I think just be aware of it. With credit cards, especially credit cards and lines of credit, it's a difficulty because we're busy. And it's not that we don't have the $15 or the $100 minimum payment. It's the fact that we're just not thinking about it.
Yeah.
And so if we could automate that, like a bill payment or a loan payment or a mortgage, then I think people would not have much problem.
I don't think a lot of people are aware that you can set the minimum payment to go off automatically every month.
Exactly.
You can also set the minimum pay or set the payment to be in full every month. So your bank will communicate with the credit card company and take the full payment out.
Yeah. And or automate it or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very helpful perspective, Richard. Thank you for joining us.
You bet.
Richard Moxley, author of The Credit Game, Rules Every Canadian Must Know to Win. His website is creditgame.net. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, the CEO of Credit Canada, Lori Campbell, is here. She's got some tips on how Canadians can get out of debt and reach their money goals. Then later in the program, do Canadians have equal access to financial advice? Here's a hint. No. We'll talk to Milo's CEO, Philip Barrar, about why that is and what can be done about it. Now, we're hanging out on the radio. I also do a lot of TV. I'm the money columnist for a show called Cityline. And segments can be found at cityline.tv, or you can check your local listings and watch live. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
More than half of Canadians are currently carrying debt, according to a new survey from Credit Canada and Capital One Canada. But although many Canadians are struggling to become debt-free, they are tackling their debt with optimism. Joining us now to tell us more about the survey and share her tips on how you can get out of debt is Credit Canada's CEO, Lori Campbell. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce.
Well, you're optimistic. I'm great. It's no surprise to me that you have a survey with the word optimism in it. What are some of the things that this survey revealed to you about Canadians and debt?
Well, certainly, Bruce, you mentioned it. Canadians are truly optimistic, and that's good because, you know, there's nothing worse than the feeling of defeat when it comes to debt. But what concerns me about this is that we're seeing that individuals, even though they have this optimism about resolving their debt, 44% saying they'd be debt free within 2 years, the results really are not good, in that many people find themselves in the same position year over year.
Right. So 2 years is a pipe dream. They're smoking some of that now legal cannabis.
Exactly. And so, you know, unless you put some real action and some real plan to getting out of debt, the chances are it's just not going to happen.
The survey found that 56% had a money vision. I don't know if I have a money vision and I do this for a living. How can I, like, what am I going to be in the 44% that don't have one? What's a money vision?
You have one in your head, I'm sure. You know, a money vision is really where you want to see your financial future. It's as simple as that.
Oh, yeah, I have that.
You have it. And it's best to put it in writing. You know, your money vision may be, again, to get out of debt within 2 years. It could be to retire within 10, 15 years. It might be to buy a new car at a certain point or buy a house. Whatever that case is, a money vision should be a map to get you there at the end of the day. So you have this great vision, you have all the roadmaps in place so that you know exactly what you're going to do with each stop sign and how you're going to actually proceed.
The survey also found that more than half of Canadians are carrying debt. And, you know, that fits with pretty much any data point we hear on debt and the real concerns that politicians, personal finance people, policymakers have about rising debt in this country. How nervous are you about that, given that this is not only what you see every day, but it's where you've spent your career? It's your life's work.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I am nervous because we are sitting right now for every dollar a Canadian makes, they owe $1.77. Now, let's put that in perspective. Back in 1990, for every dollar a Canadian made, they probably owed around 90, 95 cents. So this has doubled in the last, 20 years. But also on top of that, we're seeing consumer insolvencies increasing exponentially over the last year. We're talking almost 20%. If you look at September 2019 and compare it to September of 2018. So there's a problem out there, Bruce, and we need to start tackling it very seriously with this vision and mission to get out of debt.
Where do you think individuals should start? So I'm going to park aside the big policy questions and the things that we can do on financial literacy as educators and as governments. But for individuals who are dealing with debt, what are some things that they should focus on, as you say, to put action to it?
Well, that's one of the things that we thought about this year when we, Capital One and Credit Canada, when we put CUWC together again, is that, you know, what are the big things that people can do? Well, certainly, you know, learn from your mistakes. I mean, and don't be ashamed to talk about them. People are far too busy hiding or pretending everything is okay. Talk about what's going on with your finances and learn from your mistakes. You're coming into the Christmas season. Talk to people now about what you're willing to spend and what you can't afford to spend. Write down a plan of action to get out of debt. And I mean a plan, how much you're going to get out of debt each month. If you don't make it tangible, it's not going to happen. And then only use credit when you feel that you're using it for something that's planned, so that you're not in a situation where you're using for everyday purchases, which was one of the big things we found in our survey, is that so many people are now using credit for everyday purchases. This is problematic.
You work for an extraordinary organization that I've come to know well over the years, and one of a number in this country. Credit Canada is not the only one. Tell us more about what credit counselors can provide for people, and who should be picking up the phone and calling and talking to one of your people.
Right. Very good question. So people who are feeling not great about their finances right now, simple as that. I mean, the counseling is free. You're talking to a professional who's not going to judge you. They're going to give you options on how you can manage your debt or manage your budget. You may just want to talk about how you can budget better. You may want to find out what tools are available. You know, we have debt calculators. We have calculators on looking at interest and how much you're paying. So take a look at those. Anyone who feels that they're stressed out about money or about their finances, definitely contact a not-for-profit credit counseling service like Credit Canada to get that advice.
I ride the subway a lot, and there's lots of ads for for-profit, you know, debt consolidation services and all those kinds of things. What's the distinction? What's the difference between the nonprofit credit counselors and those who, you know, also claim to deal with your debts?
Well, be very wary, because there's a lot of companies out there that claim to improve your credit rating or help you with doing a consolidation loan or a bank an insolvency, but they're debt consultants and they will not make your situation better. They'll charge you huge fees and you'll still be in the situation where you'll need to speak to a not-for-profit credit counseling service or a trustee in bankruptcy. So steer away from those. Go to the reputable ones. Look how long they've been in business. Credit Canada's been in business for over 50 years. So look for the licensing and the reputation behind it.
It's Credit Education Week, as we've spoken about. If you were able to provide one tip and one tip only to Canadians to improve their ability to navigate these choppy waters around credit, what would that one tip be?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot.
I know. Well, you've got, what, 20, 25
can
years
I give
of
experience? You two?
You can give me two, yes.
Okay, one is to think carefully about what you're spending your money on. Think about how many hours you have to work to purchase something. I think that's very important because people work hard. They should know exactly where they're spending their money. Two, and I say this around the holidays and any other time, evaluate why you're spending money. Is it, you know, is it for, you know, to show someone how much you love them? Is it to improve your image? Is it to make yourself feel better? Evaluate that and ask yourself what your long-term goal with your money is and if that fits into that evaluation.
Lori, I always appreciate your insight and your passion.
Oh, thank you so much, Bruce.
Lori Campbell, the CEO of Credit Canada. They released a survey alongside the folks at Capital One Canada with some new insight on Canadians and their debt. Coming up later, we'll talk to Philip Barrar, founder and CEO of Milo, about how he manages his own money. It's called How I Do It. But next, we'll talk to Barrar about access to financial advice. Now, if you want to listen to some more Moolala, it's easy to access that. Go on any of the podcast platforms, find the show, and subscribe to it. And then it's automatically going to show up into your device. You can also listen to the full show or individual segments. And while you're there, write us a review. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Many Canadians live in food deserts and don't have access to healthy, reasonably priced groceries. Some of those same people are what's called unbanked. They don't have access to simple bank account. So it would follow that many Canadians don't have access to financial advice. And this is one of the issues that fires up our next guest. Philip Barrar, founder and CEO of Milo, an automated saving and investing app. Hello there, Philip.
Hey there.
How would you characterize the issue of access to financial advice? Who are you talking about and what don't they have access to? And why do you think that is? Who, what, and why?
Absolutely. I'd be talking about majority of Canadians. If you take a look at Canadian millennials today, 53% of them have less than $1,000 in the bank account, regardless of how much they make from their annual income. Today, they don't feel like they have the right tools, the right access to financial advice. The tools that our parents were using were based off of a banking infrastructure that there's a growing distrust of, mainly because they feel like there's a conflict of interest today. And now millennials are moving to things like online digital advice. And when you move to the online digital advice space, there's just so much to be able to see and read and know and to do. A lot of great material out there, but you don't know which one's most relevant for you. So people are looking for personalized digital advice, and they don't know where to get that today. Mm.
You run an online platform, helps people save and invest. The big thing when we first talked a couple years ago was the roundup feature. So you round up purchases, and that's a great way for people to save in an easy way. What are some of the opportunities of the world of online and the limitations of the world of online when it comes to access?
Absolutely. So, I mean, part of what we do is we're agnostic and we sit on top of your existing bank account. So we don't actually have you change from an RBC account to a TD account or anything like that. But in any case, we work with you in your existing life. So one of the benefits of digital is a way to integrate to your everyday life without a major change in what you have to do or a major change in habits. That's one of the things that's made it so successful, and we've been able to onboard close to 500,000 Canadians onto the saving and investing platform in the last 2 years. Now, one of the difficulties is there's so much that you have to go and do and trust. So there's still a little bit of research that you have to be able to do in order to make sure that you're signing up for the right tool, the right platform. And typically what we see millennials doing today is more about word of mouth. So people will ask their peer group, what tools are you using? How are you getting this done? Which is a new way for us to be doing that.
You have this advisor function that lives in the land of chat. So you sign up and you can communicate with an individual in a chat function. What kind of issues would a consumer be talking about with that advisor?
So people are asking everyday financial questions to the advisor. They're asking, how much house can I afford? Should I buy? Should I lease a car? How do I set up a basic budget? Essentially, anything that they would typically turn to Google to find out. But this, in this case, is actually personalized to their financial situation based off of the financial profile that they've built with Milo. So rather than having to go and search through thousands of search results, they can actually talk to a real-life human that's certified in a bite-sized way that they do for the same messaging type platform that you use to communicate with everyone and you do in your everyday life. So they can send a message, go through a direct messaging platform, and get real personalized advice directly for themselves.
What are some of the limitations of this chat functionality? Sometimes it takes a long time to get to the root of someone's money issue. I spent an hour on the phone with a listener on a whole litany of questions. It took that long to get to the real issue. Do you think chat can really address this?
So absolutely. I mean, there's a few things here. One is making sure you're asking the right questions. And that's why we use the highest qualified certified financial planners on their other end, make sure that they're asking the right things to be able to get the direct root of the questions that are being asked. The second part is sometimes there are certain questions that are just outside of the scope of bite-sized, personalized financial advice. And at that point, you want a trusted advisor to be able to push you in the right direction for where should you be looking to get this personalized advice. So estate planning, you might be able to answer some one-off questions and get a good sense of it, but you might want to put together a comprehensive financial plan that you don't know where to look. Our advisors would be able to help you and point you in the right direction for someone that you can trust.
And do you have affiliate relationships with those other service providers? Is that one of the ways in which you can make money?
No, today Advisor is a subscription-based product. We're currently in the testing phase of this product, so we're testing a price point of about $5 per month. And for the price of $5 per month, you can ask a limited amount of questions directly to the advisor, directly through that that relationship.
How do you expect to be able to pay your rent at $5? I mean, you think about an advisor who might spend, let's say they spend, 5 minutes responding to your text and you ask, 12 of those over the course of a year, that's an hour. An hour's time for a professional is, $200 to $300.
Absolutely. So we're putting in together a place with all the transactional data and financial profiles that we have to be able to optimize for those types of responses. So where it may take our traditional planner more time to be able to answer these questions, you can get the same level of response with the information that we have because we're cutting out some of the leeway to be able to get up and running for those. So we're using technology to assist the human advisor to be able to optimize their time and pass along those benefits to you.
So let's bring this back to the question of access. I mean, the issues are significant. Language barriers are challenging. Even people's ability to connect to the internet is not the same. People don't necessarily have a phone. What are some of the bigger, broader systemic issues on access that, as great as your app may be, it is unable to address?
Absolutely. So, I mean, as we're starting to take a look at international expansion, there's a certain segment that our app works really well in, right? So someone who is underbanked may work well with an app like Milo, but someone who is completely unbanked, meaning they don't have a bank account, well, then they're going to need to have the fundamental access to those types of products in order to be able to use products like Milo to get up and running. So that's where you see the Challenger Bank and Neo banks that are happening, the N26 and Revoluts of the world, and especially in the UK, starting to address this. How do you take on some of these serious access issues and be able to provide a mobile-first banking platform that allows people to be able to do things like go into retailers, to be able to do banking transactions and do other banking transactions directly on your mobile device? We're seeing fintech move forward, and it's one of the things that we're really excited about.
How do you temper your expectations for different demographics? I mentioned language. The other demographic that I think this could be tough for are seniors who don't have facility with technology. And I'm not going to stereotype. There's lots of 85-year-olds who can totally rock the iPad and, you know, build their own websites. But there are a lot of people who didn't grow up with that technology who aren't nearly as comfortable, who simply aren't going to be able to engage in an electronic way.
Absolutely. We actually have a lot of 85-year-olds on our platform, so I'm really excited to see that. And our customer support team actually takes an extra effort, schedules phone calls outside of the chat messaging platform that we typically work with most of our customers. So we do have some edge cases because we believe the Milo should be inclusive for everyone. The other part is actually looking at the other end of the spectrum, minimum age. Because these are investment accounts that we're opening up, you actually have to be 18 years old and actually to be able to open up these investment accounts. So we're looking at ways to be able to open up joint accounts with parents or be able to access the right savings products that we can actually lower that age, get more people on our platform. We have a lot more people trying to lie about their age to be old enough to be on the platform than not necessarily having access for being too old. So that's one of the things that we're looking at today. And the second part is how do we build products like Advisor to be able to span across the whole demographic? So those are the two ways that we're looking at today.
You mentioned the relationship that Milo needs to have with an individual's bank account. How do your relationships as a company work with the big banks? Because in some parts of the market, they're doing innovative things. And in other parts, they're really not. They're perfectly happy to accept the fees that come with a legacy business.
Absolutely. So, I mean, we're very complementary to banks. I mean, we use some banks as our suppliers. We are suppliers to some banks, as well as we just closed a Series A financing with National Bank and Desjardins, who put in $10 million into this round. So we see banks starting to collaborate more and more fintechs. It's no longer the fintechs versus the banks, but it's how can fintech enable these incumbents with the right technology and the right relationships to the users to help move that conversation forward. So we're seeing a lot of interesting things, and we're hoping that we can surface some of that in our new products that we're bringing to market.
I referenced Milo as an automated saving and investing app. How would you correct that phrase or say it differently so that consumers know what Milo actually does?
I think everybody has a dream, right? And whether it be moving out of their parents' house, getting married, having kids, planning a dream wedding, and Milo helps you get there. So at the end of the day, Milo helps you achieve your life goals. And we do so through saving and investing. So today, we round up your purchases and invest for a change. Also, tomorrow, you know, we're launching the advisor product to our entire platform to be able to give bite-sized, personalized advice. But one day, we'll be able to help you along the whole journey to be able to achieve those life goals.
Philip, thanks for joining us today.
No, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Philip Brar, founder and CEO of Milo. Time now for How I Do It. This is a series of basic questions about how our guests manage their own personal finances. And I would not ask any question that I would not answer myself. Our guest, Philip Brar, founder and CEO of Milo. How you doing, Philip?
I'm doing great. Thank you. How are you?
You go to a coffee shop. You buy coffee. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit? And why? And I bet I know the answer to this, given the kind of business you run. But tell me.
I use my Apple Pay. So I'm tapping with my phone directly on usually my credit card. I'm racking up those points, and then I'm paying off the credit card typically pretty frequently as I go through a lot of business spending on top of my credit cards as well.
Do you carry any cash these days?
Well, right now I have pesos, pounds, euros, and American dollars in my wallet. But that's because we've been traveling a lot, and we're realizing that in local markets, cash is typically easier. Back home, I'm only credit or debit.
What about your financial life is automated? So do you automate everything from soup to nuts, or is it particular things?
I automate everything. So I like to put in different safeguards, specifically around bill pays and credit card statements as well. So I always make sure the minimum is taken out so I never get hit with any pesky late fees or anything like that if I'm on the road and something slips through the cracks. And then I do have a level of control that I take a look at on top of the automated to just make sure that everything is within view for me.
What about retirement savings and vacation savings, maybe saving for a down payment? Are those automated too?
I use Milo. Milo is the best way to set up an automated goal for I have all three of those goals set up in my Milo account right now.
Oh, I totally set you up on that. Jeez, can't believe I did that. What are you nuts about when it comes to your money? And what are you kind of casual about? So maybe you're like nuts about what you spend on groceries and casual about the price you pay on insurance or whatever. What's your specific version of nuts versus casual?
So I'm totally nuts about getting the best deal for whatever it is, whether it be racking up hotel points and getting free nights, whether it be making sure I have the best flights, reshopping my insurance on a regular basis and getting the lowest mortgage rate. I'm always making sure I'm getting the best value for my dollar. What I'm casual about is probably taking friends out for dinner. So I'm happy to host either a barbecue at my house for our 40 employees, and which we do on a quarterly basis, or going out with friends. I'm happy to host them as well.
Do you have an actual financial plan? And what I mean by that is a document or a file that looks at the current state of your finances and outlines the actions you need to take to get to your goals.
I have one that's probably updated on a weekly basis. So
a weekly basis?
I'm always looking at it. I'm a nerd for all this personal finance material. I go in and whenever I read an article, I go back and I relook at my plan. I take a look at how I can tweak it or what I can look at. Typically, things don't change too often. But yeah, I actually have a plan that I reference quite often.
Do you ever resource the services of a financial advisor?
We're lucky that we have some in-house. So we just launched Milo Advisor, and we have access to chat message-based advisors. And I message them during every investment pitch that we do and every time we do a demo.
What's inside your portfolio?
Ooh, that's just passive ETF strategy. So I'm using the Milo product, and so I'm using that. And I'm also an investor personally in Milo as well. So I guess you can say you have a little bit of private investment there.
Sure.
Too.
Do you or would you hold an income property? Is that appealing to you, or are you like, ugh, leave the 2 a.m. calls about a plug toilet to somebody else?
I'm very handy. I love building things. I actually purchased my first income property about a year ago, so I'm very happy with it.
What's the best part of it? What's the worst part of it so far?
Best part of it is it came with a tenant already, he pays his rent every single time on time. The worst part is you join a Facebook group where everybody complains. So you get to see a whole other building's group of complaints.
Oh, right. What would you say has been your best financial move?
Funny story. So back in 2013, I bought a Volkswagen Jetta, and they had a recall where they actually bought back the car plus some. So I got to drive a car for free for 4 years.
Wow.
Turned around and used those funds as a down payment on the house. So it was a fluke and the funny story, but that was one of my by accident best financial moves.
Okay, and worst? What was your worst financial move?
I started a t-shirt company when I was 21 years old and put all my savings directly into that. You know, went from being a broke student to a broke entrepreneur, and that's when I became really good with personal finance.
Right.
I wanted to make a dollar stretch, and then that's what I had to do.
I hope you're still wearing those t-shirts. I'm sure they look great. I'm sure they're classic.
Absolutely.
Who files your taxes, you or a professional?
I have a professional. I'm a dual citizen, so it gets a little bit complicated.
What if you have kids? You don't have kids yet, right?
Not yet.
No. So if one day you have kids, what is the single biggest thing you will want to teach them about money?
It has to go back to opportunity identification. I think you want to teach your kids the tools to be an entrepreneur, and that they have the skill set to be able to succeed in this world. So just being frugal, making sure that they are taking a data-driven approach to what they're doing and identifying the right opportunities and having the hustle to go after it. So I think it's really just taking the entrepreneurial approach to life.
That's great. Philip, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Our guest today, Philip Brar, he's the founder and CEO of Mylo. He joined us from Mexico City, and we had a little bit of static on the line, but it was still worth it. That is how he does his money. That is our show for today. Here's your homework. You have a couple pieces of homework. Subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. Subscribe to the show on your podcast platform. Bonus marks if you write us a review. You can also send your comments and questions to ask@moolala.ca. And don't forget to connect with me on social media. You can follow me on Facebook, Bruce Selry Moolala, Twitter @Bruce Selry. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.